Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
On this episode of Narcissist Apocalypse, we talk with an abuse survivor named Aurora. And Aurora was married to a covert narcissist. It's a story of trauma responses, future faking, coming out, and changing abuse tactics. Welcome to Narcissist Apocalypse, everyone. This is a podcast that gives a voice to survivors of toxic relationships. I am Brandon Chadwick, but my friends call me Chad, and thanks for tuning into this episode. So what is a narcissist, you may ask? Well, for the purposes of this podcast, we refer to a narcissist as anyone who has displayed a pattern of behavior that shows a limited capacity to appreciate others' perspectives. It is that simple. And now, before we get to our episode with Aurora, I just want to tell everyone in the Narcissist Apocalypse community that wants to be on our show, please go to NarcissistApocalypse.com. At the top of the page, there's a guest form button. Press that button, fill out the form, and away we will go from there. Another way to be on our show is to be part of our Letters to My Narcissist compilation episode. And again, go to NarcissistApocalypse.com. On the side of the page, it says Send Voicemail. You click that button, it records up to 5 minutes. Press it twice, records up to 10. We are accumulating these letters for a volume 6 of our Letters to My Narcissist compilation episode. And if you do not want to read the letter yourself and you want me or my old pal Melissa to read the letter for you, just send us an email at narcissistapocalypse@gmail.com. So now a little bit of an announcement. You know, this show, our groups, and our support services are paid for on a real shoestring budget. So if you think what we offer with this podcast is valuable, not just to you, but to other people as well, please consider donating to our cause. Right now, every expense comes directly out of my own pocket. And in order to grow the show, reach a larger audience, and help more people, we need a little bit of help. So sponsoring an episode of this podcast is a way to make a really big difference. And at the same time, you'll be helping thousands of survivors too. And this episode is sponsored by Fern Braislaw. And from the bottom of my heart, Fern Braislaw, thank you so much for doing this, for coming up with the idea for doing this. And from everyone who is listening, you know, everyone is thanking you, Fern. I am thanking you. Seriously, a big, big, huge thank you, Fern. You are my hero today. You were my hero last week when we discussed all of this. And I swear, really, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for doing this. And for everyone else who is listening, if you want to sponsor next week's episodes or multiple episodes, we've set up a payment on our Patreon. So please go to our Patreon at patreon.com/narcissistapocalypse. And you will get a special thank you at the beginning of each episode if you want to sponsor one from here on out. So again, thank you to Fern for sponsoring this week's episode. And now, without further ado, my episode with Aurora is about to come up. We discussed briefly, there's talk of sexual abuse. There's talk of physical abuse. There's trigger warnings there. There's every abuse here. There's emotional abuse. There's financial abuse. This was an episode where after we recorded it, I think I really must have been tired after, like, it might have been late at night, I think, when we recorded it. And I remember I put it on the Patreon and I said, hey, this episode needs work. I need notes on this. And there was one person on our Patreon that wrote, listen to it, because I hadn't listened back yet. And they said, this episode doesn't need notes. And I still hadn't listened to it. And I finally re-listened to it. And I have no idea what I was thinking about anything needing notes or anything, because this episode is from start to finish a pretty interesting episode. It jam-packed with so many quotes. It is such a helpful episode. You know, it's not there, it's a faith abuse story, but it's not just a faith abuse story. It's all different types of abuse that are going on here. You'll resonate a lot with it. And I really want to thank Aurora for being part of the show. She's an amazing person, and you'll hear it in her voice of how far she's come. And, you know, without further ado, big thank you to Aurora for doing the show. Here is my episode with Aurora. Welcome to Narcissist Apocalypse, everyone. With me today, I have Aurora. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Well, today you are here to tell a story, and you're about to tell a story of growing up in a religious family, how that shaped you. You know, and how the abuse inside that family shaped you as well. And then you're also going to tell us a story about being in a relationship with a covert narcissist after the fact and how that affected you. But also we're going to hear a coming of age story at the same time and everything you've discovered about yourself. So I just want to thank you for being here today. I know you're going to help a lot of people. And now without further ado, Aurora, the floor is now yours.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for having me a part of a big piece of my journey out of narcissistic abuse has been just sharing my story and how sharing helps both me. And then what I'm realizing is how much it helps other people who have experienced similar things. All right. So I'm just going to start from the beginning, the beginning being a long, long time ago. And as you mentioned, I was raised in a religious household. While there are so many good things that can come from that, there's also a lot that can condition you to accept certain behaviors. One of my parents worked for a church, and there were a lot of expectations put onto us as not only a family and a family unit, but also as individuals. You know, there was sort of this them that was always watching us, you know, this greater them, the church people, the church leadership, the, you know, and anything that we did as kids was a reflection on, you know, my parents. And so there was just a lot of pressure to be a certain way, to do things a certain way as kids. Now, you know, in my deconstruction process and in, finding community with other, you know, ex-evangelicals, there's definitely, a spectrum out there. There's always somebody who had it worse and somebody who, you know, experienced worse things in their childhood, right? But what I've learned now in my therapy journey is how much I was conditioned and how much I learned to have that mindset, to minimize what I had been through. I was not beaten as a child, and I am so grateful for that. I was not deprived of any physical needs, and that is so fantastic. So because of those things, and, you know, you learn to minimize the things that you do experience, the trauma that you do endure as a child. Another, you know, major component in that is I would travel with my family to do just short-term mission trips, typically abroad in third world countries. So when as a young child and all through your childhood, you are on, you know, sort of a seasonal basis, like during the summers, we would go and spend time, you know, building homes and doing all these things, but you're exposed to this extreme poverty, this extreme way of life. While that does provide and sort of instill in you this great sense of gratitude as a child, it also is a great tool to help you minimize your issues, right? I mean, every year I was going and I was being reminded, my life is not this. My life is not as bad as it is here, right? So the neglect that I'm experiencing, the shame that I'm enduring, the name calling, the, you know, all these things that I'm enduring are not as big of a deal, right? Because I go to a good school. I have food on the table. There's so much of my world was just through this toxic lens that obviously I did not know was toxic at the time. So I think another big component is even how cyclical and generational abuse can be within family structures. So for instance, both of my parents came from from pretty toxic family structures. There was this mentality of staying married no matter what. So recently I was at my grandfather's funeral, and he was married to my grandmother for 52 years. And my grandmother, while, you know, obviously was never diagnosed or anything, I believe that she was both narcissistic and then potentially had a borderline personality disorder. Either way, she touched on, she manifested a lot of the criteria of any of those cluster B personality disorders. But at my grandfather's funeral, this quiet, meek, mild, this codependent enabler, all we talked about was her. All anyone talked about was how he was such a saint for having stayed with her his whole life, and how that already was just so ingrained in me, even as a child, to stay in a relationship. It's more important to be married. It's more important to reflect that that's what God wants for you than to protect yourself, than to believe yourself, to understand yourself. So those were sort of like those underlying, you know, themes in my childhood, in my youth, that really set the stage and set a good pattern for me to then tolerate the abuse that I endured later in life. Another major component, too, that played a big role in my story is also in my sexuality. So from a young age, probably as young as I can remember, I was always attracted to girls. And so much of what the church can teach and preach about sexuality and homosexuality specifically is it teaches you to gaslight yourself. It teaches you to discredit your own reality with those, sure, well-meaning maybe phrases of, this is just a phase, you'll grow out of this, you don't feel that way. You know, everybody thinks that at some point, or, you know, there's all these things that you, that was another major piece that had me so conditioned to gaslighting. The church is an expert gaslighter. There's so much of it that is just you know, you might be feeling, even in a sermon, you might be feeling this, but that's not what God wants. God wants this. And so doubt yourself and trust in this. And so there were so many pieces of this puzzle that just fell perfectly for me to learn in my crucial developmental years, to not trust myself, to not trust my instincts, to not trust that I knew what I wanted. And that self-doubt played a major role in staying in this abusive relationship for a long, long time.
So while you're growing up, let's say you're a teenager, and are you questioning things? Are you questioning the system that you're in? Do you have a feeling that something isn't adding up, or at this point you don't have enough of a, what's the best way to put it, of a frame of reference of what life is like somewhere else to understand that this doesn't work for you, or this whole system, something here doesn't feel right to me?
That's a great question. So I would like to say I fell somewhere in the middle of those things. I was not raised in such a conservative Christian environment to where I couldn't wear pants, or I could, you know, like I went to public school. I had a semi-normal childhood, and I was well aware of a lot of the realities of the world. I wasn't overly sheltered in that way. But what kept me there was knowing that if I chose these other things, that I would not find the love and acceptance from my family that I desperately wanted. And so that was sort of the theme of my childhood was, we always had free choice, right? We had this, we were able to choose if we wanted this. We had to go and attend church, but we didn't have to believe it if we didn't want to. But we knew that that would come with the cost, that would come with the rejection from our parents. That I was, I think, 15 years old, and at that point, I was obviously already questioning my sexuality. You know, I was already experimenting with it. And I remember vividly, my dad told me, you know, he was sort of just sitting me down for, you know, a normal little heart-to-heart, like, oh, I'm here. I'm always here for you. If you need help, what he was really getting at was like, if you ever find yourself in a pickle, right? Like you're drunk at a party or something like that, like call me, I will come and get you. So he was giving me this reassurance of like, I am here. I'm always here for you. I will always do anything you need. And he ended it with just don't be a lesbian. And sorry. and I think that was the moment when I knew that even if I was bisexual or you know, I had no term or understanding for what my sexuality was at that point. But at that point, I knew that I had to choose. I had to choose a certain thing to, in order to earn their love, I had to be a certain way. I had to give up these pieces of me. So it was both. I would say I probably was aware that that I lived in this Christian bubble, right? That I lived in this little, perfect world. And I mean, honestly, I started drinking when I was 15. I wasn't this perfect Christian girl, but I was able to hide that side of me really well. You know, and I turned to all kinds of things to just deal with the pain. But yeah, so it was both and. I knew about the rest of the world, but I was still choosing the love and acceptance from my family.
So once you left, I guess, the home, or you turned 18, what were the expectations of what your life was supposed to look like, or what you were supposed to be?
Mm-hmm.
Did they want you to be, like, you know, independent and, you know, get a degree and, you know, find a job that you liked? Or was the expectation, otherwise, that you're, you know, family, you know, build a family, et cetera, et cetera. And, kind of not do as you're told, but like, this is, you know, silently maybe what's expected. And then also, what was the actuality of that?
So I would say it was again, a both and situation. So there were just a lot of expectations. You know, there was the expectation of an education. So to go to school, to get a degree, to get a good job, while also the expectation of, you know, find a husband, settle down, have children. You know, there are sort of those, even if those were slightly unspoken, but those expectations within our family structure. So the way I was able to sort of manage all of that was I went to the university where my parents met, and I majored in the major that my dad majored in, just, you know, seeking more and more approval. And I ended up dating my now ex-husband. We started dating when we were in college. So it was sort of this perfect storm of finally being what my parents wanted me to be. I was, you know, getting an education. I was going to graduate, get a good job, and the cherry on top, I was going to walk out of college with, you know, jokingly, they call it getting your MRS degree, your Mrs. degree. So then I was going to walk out of college also, you know, getting married, engaged and getting married. So I was just still so stuck in that toxic family structure of my own upbringing that I knew that I needed these things. And obviously, I mean, being a human being who's capable of love, you know, I also wanted these things on some level. I wanted that, you know, I wanted marriage. I wanted a companionship. I wanted a relationship. And so now I'll just dive into how he and I met. Mm-hmm. Is that good?
Kind of
at that point.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. So we met through a mutual friend. My best friend, she was dating a guy in a dorm room adjacent to his. So there, you know, it was kind of like I was hanging out with my friend and she was with her boyfriend and he brought his friends. And so there was just sort of this mutual group. And we all went to a church ministry together at the university that we went to. And I just remember he was quiet. He was so kind and patient. He was just this rock, like this steady rock, if that makes sense. And I was kind of all over the place. I was, you know, trying to get, you know, get myself out of my party girl phase. And I was trying to, again, be what my parents wanted me to be. I was trying to just get my life on a better path, so to speak. And he was just this solid, quiet, so kind, incredibly kind person. So early on, we, you know, there were a lot of the future faking. I mean, really everything that goes hand in hand with narcissistic abuse was there. Just sort of him even laying the groundwork for the gaslighting that would come later once the devaluation and the manipulation and the stonewalling began. But really early on in our dating and even in our engagement period, there was not a lot of those major red flags. Anything that came up that was a red flag, I remember thinking and just accepting, we are young, right? Like we were 19 when we started dating. And so, and we got married when we were 22 years old. So I remember thinking, you know what, like, he's just still young. He will grow out of some of this, right? Like this is something that he can learn over time. And so that was a lot of what sort of, you know, kept me from acting on any of the red flags that came up early in our dating, which were very few and far between. The mask, the narcissistic mask, was there and very strong through our dating and our engagement period. I remember we were engaged at that point. It was spring semester of senior year of college, and my mom had come up to visit just for a little bit, and she was asking me, you know, like, why marry him? And I remember telling her, I've never met anyone this kind before. I've never met someone who was so just wholeheartedly kind. And I told her, it doesn't matter what life is going to bring us, like whatever challenges, like I know that life gets hard and we're young and we have so much we're going to face, but if I can face it with someone this kind, with someone who cares about me this much and who is on my team this much, like I know we'll get through anything. So I was fully, I mean, I was either fully blinded by it, but honestly, I have spent, you know, years in therapy unpacking all of this, and I for the life of me cannot think of any major, major red flags early, early on in my relationship with the narcissist.
I have a question.
Yeah, of course.
What was his family like?
That's exactly what I was about to get to. So I'm working through my sheet here so I don't forget anything. And next one, red flags, his family. Okay. So,
because I was about to say, you know, if he's not showing any signs when you meet his family, meet his family, they might not have the same holding on to their masks in the same way and on the best behavior.
Absolutely. So maybe here we go.
You know, for people who are listening who are young right now, sometimes the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And so if you're paying attention to how the family is acting and everything, you know, keep that in mind.
So, yes, the biggest red flag early on, beyond just sort of our age and my ability to sort of minimize, like, oh, he'll get out, he'll grow out of this. That's no big deal. And then even sort of the religious aspects of our, you know, relationship, but we'll get into more of that later. Definitely his family. So he is the golden child in the toxic family structure within his family. So he is just put together. He has all his ducks in a row. He is kind and nice and organized. And his family, I personally have never, and I'm an extrovert. I'm an extreme extrovert. I have a lot of friends. I meet a lot of different people. I have never met a family structure that was more toxic, more obviously toxic, and more noticeably just different. At the time, what I sort of chalked it up to was just, you know, some of them are shy or, you know, they just need to kind of figure it out. Again, my metric for measuring a healthy family was already skewed because I was told that my family was extremely healthy. I was told that my family was incredible, right? We had that enmeshment. We had that our family is great. We do all these trips together. We do all these things. We're so close. When in reality, that's not what I felt with my family, right? And I was experiencing that narcissistic cycle of abuse within my family even. And so for me to see this, for me to reject him because of his family felt counterintuitive. Like it felt dishonest because A, they had a lot of the toxic traits that my family had. It manifested very differently, but they had a lot of the same toxic traits. But how could I, you know, disown him because of his family when he was accepting me because of my family? Like, despite my family, I should say. So I think, so his family structure, his parents are now divorced, and I don't know much about his father. That's been a big sort of piece of my journey in out of all of this, because my ex, he shared very little about his childhood. He never really opened up about much of his childhood or much of his upbringing. He would always say he didn't remember, which, if you know anything about how the mind reacts to trauma, part of that could be true. It could be some solid dissociation, right? He could be, his mind is protecting him from the trauma of his childhood, and so he truly does not remember. But it could also be, you know, just another manipulation tactic of the narcissist, to not share too much of what he has going on, but to just want to hear what I have going on. So, you know, his siblings, the one I believe is diagnosed borderline personality disorder, but that didn't come until more recent years. If I had to, you know, from what I know, I believe there's also some antisocial personality disorder, and there's extreme codependency. There's extreme enmeshment, and the role reversal. The you know, it's extremely, extremely toxic. The verbal abuse, the manipulation, the gaslighting, they all do that to each other and with each other. But again, I did not know these terms. I didn't know any of this. I thought, sure, his family's messed up. And honestly, as someone who's extremely empathetic, that was almost a selling point for him. I could love him out of this terrible family, right? I could give him the space to finally experience what love would look like instead of having to face the fact that whatever his upbringing was had a major effect on who he is and would become. So then the mask didn't really slip. And the reality, I guess, it didn't really set in until we were formally married. So we got married right after college, the summer after our senior year of college. And we immediately moved down down to the south in the United States, and just a different state, different city. One of our main motivations in that, one of my main motivations in that, was to get further away from his family and the codependent expectations they had for us. You know, like having dinner over there several nights a week, or, you know, and it was, there needed to be, because they were so disrespectful of boundaries and would not understand if we said, no, we're going to do this. We needed a physical boundary. We needed something bigger.
So was he complaining about the boundaries to you, or was it something that you noticed on your own?
So a lot of that I sort of noticed on my own, and I was always sort of trying to get him to see it, right? But him being the golden child, him also with his narcissistic traits, it was so much of, like, now knowing what I know, he didn't want to reject them because they were a piece of him, you know? So he would always try to sort of spin it like they meant well, and yes, they have some issues, but, you know, it's, again, that minimizing. So he would get on the same page as me sometimes, when it benefited him. And then sometimes he would blame me for having left. And, you know, for having moved or for taking him away from his family. But it really just, that was part of that cycle of abuse. It really depended on the day, right? It was, if he was love bombing, then it was, yeah, my family's messed up and, you know, it's good that we get some space. But then if it was the devaluation, then it was, no, this is your fault. Like, why are you taking me away from my family? They actually care about me, all this stuff. So once we had moved and settled down, that was when I started noticing for the first time, just this even small little lies. So I had flown down to the city where we were living, and we sent me down with a one-way ticket to find a job. And I got a job the next day. So then he just had to pack up all our stuff and drive down. And he was driving down with his friend from college and like to help him. And then when he arrived, his friend wasn't with him. And I was so confused because as I had spoken with him on the phone while we were moving, you know, he would like whisper and be like, oh, he's sleeping right now. You know, like I can't talk. Like it was this, it was so strange. Like just these small little things where he didn't necessarily even have to lie about, but he chose to. Yeah. And then as soon as we were down there, the blame game really picked up. It was a lot of blame for, he was really angry that we had moved down there, that he had no say in it, and that I was, you know, extremely controlling, and that this was all me manipulating him. That was really sort of when that the gaslighting of those types of underlying, I can't think of the word. You know, he was constantly telling me that I was controlling, mm-hmm. that I was selfish, that I was bossy, that I always got what I wanted.
Did you start thinking that that was true, or were you able to shake that off?
I absolutely believed him. That was one of probably the biggest drawing points. It, now in reflecting, that's probably one of the things that he was most drawn to in me, was because that was the same narrative that I had heard as a child, that I was too much, that I wanted way too much. I was too noisy. I was, you know, what really was just a child, you know, who's unable to express, hey, my needs aren't being met. My basic, like, emotional needs are not being met. You know, manifested as sort of this, I'm going to put it in air quotes, but problem child situation. Because I never got into any actual real trouble. And I got great grades and all the things. And, yeah, I had, you know, that party girl phase and everything. But it wasn't that. I was told that I was a very bad child. I was told that they used to say, oh, I can't wait till you have kids. You know, like, I hope you have one that's just like you. And, like, just so I could sort of get a taste of my own medicine, right?
So so you are in this relationship. And, you know, the whole love bombing type of stage really, you know, went from, you know, this is just a nice guy. This is a guy, he's kind mm-hmm. guy. And now you are, you know, you're married, you've moved, and you're in this area, new area, and you are, you know, just trying to make your way in the world. And this kind of stuff is happening. It's stuff that you're used to. So it's probably not throwing you off that much because you grew up around this type of behavior. So it's not something that's really going to, you know, make you run for the hills, you know, immediately. And now you're hearing this stuff where you're believing these things about yourself that he's telling you, as far as, you know, you being selfish, or, you know, your needs are not important. When he says those things, how do you respond to him? And does that manifest in other ways inside of you physically? Are you getting depressed and not able to put fingers on anything?
Absolutely. So, now I'll kind of get into like what was a major turning point and even just sort of like assessing my own trauma responses to all of this. So early on, and even in my adolescence, my go-to trauma response, so that fight, flight, fawn, or freeze, my go-to was fight. I don't know if you're familiar with the Enneagram at all, but I am an Enneagram 8, the Challenger.
I'm an Enneagram 6.
Oh, it's 6. All right. For the loyalist. I have a lot of 6s in my life. So the 8, is sort of known for this aggressive demeanor, right? This sort of loud and boisterous. They, in a healthy state, will fight for the underdog, right? They become the protector. But in this unhealthy state, they are, you know, some of the not greatest people on planet Earth.
I know, because so, I don't get along with them at all when they're in their unhealthy state.
Eights are usually the worst. I usually have to say I'm an Enneagram 8, and I'm sorry on behalf of all 8s.
That's funny.
You know, that's just how it goes. But even that, so even Enneagram, so he used a lot of that in our marriage to as a part of the manipulation, right? Like that 8s are bad. 8s aren't good. 8s are aggressive. 8s are problematic instead of the really good qualities that come with an 8, the really protective qualities, and a healthy 8 who is in touch with their feelings and able to be vulnerable. Like those are some of the greatest like traits that can come about. Like it's when they are acting more in their area of growth, which is to become a 2, the helper, when they have sort of a more external focus.
So I have one question for you. As an 8 in your levels of health, have you ever been in the bottom 3 levels of unhealthy, and how did you act then?
Absolutely. So that would be like adolescence. So when I was like 15, 16, so self-destructive behaviors, I would drink all the time. I drank before school. I was extremely promiscuous, and I was extremely selfish, extremely independent, that hyper independent, I don't need anybody, I don't need, you know, and honestly just extremely angry. I was very angry for a very long time. So my initial sort of gut trauma response to a lot of what he was sort of doing, that initial like blame shifting, when he would even get in a funk and shut down, I used to call it that, in a funk instead of stonewalling. I would get angry. I would get mad. I would speak up. And so things were getting more and more tense in our relationship, because me speaking up did nothing but sort of fuel the fire even more. So it was kind of this snowball effect of his mask coming off. It was the abuse really started to pick up. It was that emotional abuse, the financial abuse, the psychological abuse, the sexual abuse, and then what eventually manifested in physical abuse. So we were about a year into our marriage, and he had sort of taken it to that level. And it was, you know, one very specific instance. It was New Year's Eve, and we went out with some friends. And towards the end of the evening, publicly out in this nightclub, he threw me up against the wall and called me a fucking cunt. And, you know, just kind of went on and on, which that was always kind of his favorite little nickname for me, so to speak. And at that point, I changed my tune. So a lot of people in my life even sort of knew this story from early on in our marriage of how things were awful. We used to call it the dark days. He and I would reference it as the dark days. This time when things were just bad, right? It was, but we don't need to dwell on it anymore. We can move forward with this. And so after that incident, my trauma response shifted. So I no longer engaged with him. I no longer fought back with him. I no longer stood up for anything that I needed. I just met my own needs and then made sure to take care of him and tiptoe around him, because I never wanted to face that physical abuse ever again. And so at that point, not consciously, but it just naturally happened. He had finally worn me down to that point. And I got to a point where my new trauma response became fawn. It just became that people pleasing. I could not leave my marriage because of, if you recall, that belief within my family structure. You stay married no matter what. It doesn't matter what's going on. You stay in that marriage and you will be praised for it. You'll be honored because you are willing to stay with someone who is so difficult to love. And, so at that point, my shift led to, I think he also realized, how I describe it a lot is early on in our relationship, the abuse was sloppy. He hadn't really perfected his craft. He was sort of pushing my boundaries, seeing how far he could go. And I think at that point he realized that was too far. So he had to rein in his abuse, right? He had to make it manifest in these other ways. And so I used to, after our arguments, I used to type out, hey, what happened? I would just do a play-by-play of what happened. Because somehow in our arguments, it would always turn out that that wasn't what happened, right? Like the gaslighting was so intrinsic. I have notes and notes and notes in my phone of what the argument just was, like what actually transpired. Like you said this, I did this, this happened, then we went to sleep or whatever. You know, like it wasn't because he would get in my brain and convince me that it didn't happen that way. And so I started to take notes. I started to just jot down everything that happened. And so here's a note I'd love to read some of, and it's just, this is after that major, the physical abuse and that incident. And it's a few days later, it's 3 days later, I had asked him to go to therapy on his own, and not do, you know, couples, but that he needed to go by himself and deal with some of this stuff. So I'm just going to share just a little piece of it here. I wanted to clarify a few things. My wanting you to go to therapy is not to insult you. It's not to put you down or to make you feel that I'm putting all of the blame on you for the problems that we have been having this year. My observations over the last year have shown that some of the source of much of my pain has stemmed from your treatment of me. When you lash out at me, call me names, threaten divorce, cut me down with your words, it's one of the worst ways that you can hurt me. Words are important to me. I will take both the positive and negative to heart. When I fell in love with you, it was because of your truly kind and caring heart. You were different from everyone else. You were one of the nicest people that I knew. You used to say the nicest things to me. I am not an idiot, and I know that people change and people will stop trying as hard to impress their spouse over time. I just thought we would get to this level of complacency much later in life. I expected this time in our lives, this time here alone in this new city, to be a chance to fall deeper and deeper in love with no distraction, nothing to consume our free time, but how to love each other better. It breaks my heart to think that you have given up already. You're ready to throw in the towel and throw destructive words at me. Here's where I get stuck every time with how things are going, regardless of who starts the argument or what it's about. What ends up happening is you get backed into a corner. And even reading this, I'm sure you're getting that backed into a corner feeling right now. I'm sure it's hard for you to read this and listen to what I have to say because you're trying to keep it fair. You're coming up with what I do wrong and how that's my problem too. You're already writing your version to me. So as you can see, I already was noticing a lot of these patterns, and this was 1 year into our marriage. So this was quite early in our marriage. And I had confronted him. I had asked him, the note goes on and on, you know, but I had asked him to go to therapy and, he refused. He said, no, the only thing he would agree to was couples therapy. And then that kind of began the journey of, how other people, like the professionals that we brought in and the pastors that we brought in, how that sort of really perpetuated this cycle of abuse and perpetuated the gaslighting. So we would go to a counselor and, you know, the counselor is, you know, trained to you know, listen openly to both sides. And again, when you don't know that narcissism is there, when you don't know that it's that narcissistic abuse and it's just problems in your marriage, right? They'll offer you a communication technique, right? We went to therapy so many times to learn every kind of communication tech, like the Imago dialogue, we've done every kind of communication technique that's out there, where you share and then you reflect and then you respond and, you know, all the things. And they never work. They never once work. And our therapy sessions would always end because of, you know, money or, which what I'm now realizing was the therapist was starting to see through him, right? They were starting to see the mask slip, and then it was time to stop therapy or to find a different therapist. And so, and it was never individual therapy. It was always couples, because then there could always be some of the blame shifted onto me. The therapy was a big piece of our marriage. And I think it was one of the things that, I think, again, helped me believe that things were changing for the better, right? He was willing to go to therapy. Sure, not individual, but couples. And we were working on these things. Were those things still there? Yes, absolutely. But they were so much more subtle. They were so much more hidden. And he became better, like I said, at his craft. He knew how, when, where, and how much was too much to gaslight me, to manipulate me, to control me. So, and at that point, I had shifted my trauma response. I was no longer willing to engage with him, right? And so I essentially had begun almost a gray rock method within my marriage. I almost started to offer him next to nothing, right? I was so shut down from him that it wasn't a real marriage, right? As long as I didn't give him anything, as long as I wasn't vulnerable, as long as I, you know, then, which as an Enneagram 8, that's our biggest fear, is to be controlled, is to be vulnerable. And I've done a lot of reflection on how that also played a role, that I was willing to not be vulnerable because I'm an 8. So I was willing to stay in this marriage, even though it was lacking completely lacking intimacy, emotional intimacy. So then we had a couple of things happen, just like we lost one of our dear friends passed away. And, you know, that was just kind of a life-altering situation, which honestly just sort of took my mind off of the relationship and the issues. I was so distracted with helping my friend, you know, overcome that situation, that then life just sort of brought its distractions. And I think I had sort of succumbed to, this was my reality, right? Again, back to that pattern from my family, like, you stay married no matter what. So I can stay married if he's going to, you know, if we're going to couples therapy, if we're working on these things. And even though it's, my body was telling me it was not working, my body was telling me that the tension was there. My body was shutting down, but it was still, I was still just so stuck. There was no way out for me. If I left, I would have nothing, because I knew my family would disown me. And, you know, we were young and poor, and, you know, I was so trapped. I even tried to leave once. After that incident, the next day I packed a bag and I walked down to a coffee shop up the street, and I was trying to decide what to do. And I called a friend who was living in another state, and I was like, I don't know what to do. I have nowhere to go. You know, and she was like, you should go home, go see your parents. And I was like, yeah, but, you know, that narrative was there, right? That there was no... there was no such thing as divorce in my family. And that wasn't an option. And I remember wheeling my bag back home, to him. And at that point, I mean, that was when I think for him, he knew that trauma bond was set in stone, that there was no going back for me. So then we sort of just settled into this rhythm, right? It became sort of these normalcies. It was, I'd wake up and I never knew what I was going to get, because the love bombing with covert is phenomenal, right? Like, I mean, with all narcissists, it's exactly what you want to hear. It's this perfect, you know, just everything you want to hear. And then there's the name calling, the devaluation, and then it leads to our typical cycle. So he typically would stonewall for 3 days. That was kind of the standard amount of time. And like I said, I always called it in a funk. And I remember early on being like, how can I help you get out of this funk? Like, I'm seeing it as like, he just needs some space, right? He just needs some time to decompress, to think about things. And that's okay. Because I also have that hyper independence from my childhood as a trauma response. So I don't mind being independent, right? Like, so I had time for me to do me things. But eventually his manipulation led to me not engaging in me things during the stonewalling, because that was going to be met with more manipulation. So, then fast forward and we started having children. Again, at this point, I'm thinking our marriage is safe, right? Like, he doesn't hit me anymore. He's so different now, different being, you know, very relative. But the abuse was different. I just did not know that emotional abuse was a thing. I didn't. If I had known that, my childhood would have crumbled, right? My everything would have, the bubble would have burst if I had known that emotional abuse was abuse. And so for me, it was just kind of normal, right? It's normal to feel like garbage around the people that you love and to have to pretend and to have to tiptoe, right? Because that's what I had done my whole life. So I just tiptoed around those eggshells and he would, you know, keep to his cycle of abuse. And I developed extreme hypervigilance. So I was just constantly go, 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 go. As long as I just kept going, 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 doing, 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 and, you know, just running around like a chicken with my head cut off. As long as I maintained that, then things were okay. So I don't know if you have children, but it's quite a journey. I love my children so much. But having children is this huge life-changing event. And it is, it became so much more challenging for me to tiptoe around his eggshells, because my capacity was just filled with being a mother of a young child. And so things started to sort of pick up again once we had children. I remember postpartum with my firstborn. I had pretty bad postpartum depression. And I would just lay in bed crying every single night. Like, I would just cry myself to sleep and just laying next to him, you know? And that was kind of a normal for us too. I have so many memories of just laying in bed crying. And I knew he heard, you know, I was trying to be quiet, but I knew he heard. I knew he knew. And that he wasn't comforting me, or, you know, like, it wasn't just like laying in bed crying and he's holding me. It was like me curled up on my side. And I remember even telling him like I wanted to die, and that I, you know, it was, he then took that time. So in that postpartum period, he signed us up for couples therapy again because he wasn't feeling love. And, obviously I was struggling, right? Like, just, I was really struggling. And we get to the counselor, you know, and he essentially waltzes me in, and it's just like, she's a mess, you know, like, I don't feel loved by her at all. She doesn't do any of the things she used to do, because hypervigilance is what maintained my relationship, right? So that go, that cooks the meals that he likes and do the things, you know, and now that I was very sedentary, right? My postpartum, I was just low. I needed help, obviously, but, you know, and I tried to sort of, you know, explain that I was like, I'm just postpartum, I'm dealing with a lot. And, you know, I wish that he would, you know, just like recognize that it's a season, right? You know, like that, can't he help himself right now so that I can at least just take care of me and the baby? But, you know, then we no longer went to see that therapist ever again, of course. throughout all of this too, he's an Enneagram one. And so he's a perfectionist, and like extreme perfectionist, and, eating disorder, was really starting to pick up. There was always some new diet, right? We were vegetarian, we were vegan, we were paleo, we were keto, we were, you know, there was sort of always chasing this, ideal body, style. And then also, a lot of it was even just the control, right? Just being able to control it and move into some different diet. But then I was responsible for cooking, so I had to then take on these diets as well. That was a lot of the, like, really subtle control and manipulation was the body image stuff that he pushed. You know, and having babies, I don't know if you've heard this, but your body changes a little bit. So there was a lot of just shame there, you know, shame around my body postpartum, and I felt out of control. One of the things I learned to do as a coping mechanism, right, was to control my body. I dieted. I was constantly trying to be thinner and do all these things so that he would, like, to avoid those eggshells, right? That was another just trap in our marriage. So, but when you have children, it's really challenging to, like, uphold those physical ideals. And, you know, he would say, like, subtly say things like his, you know, like his ultimate fantasy was like some, like, workout, you know, attire. And, like, just as these subtle jabs of, like, he wants someone really fit. Then there's also the piece of motherhood that also just transforms you, right? You can kind of see it as taking a sense of yourself away, but it's also so rewarding as well. So I think the motherhood almost, the guise of motherhood, I guess I was able to project that onto motherhood, right? That I felt different. I felt worse. I felt terrible because of motherhood, not because of him, not because of all the abuse, right? It was motherhood. Like, I had, my life was changing. So of course I felt terrible. So I ended up having a second child as to see if that would actually help with the postpartum depression, because he was very anti-medication. You know, just that, like, food is our medicine type mentality, or and whereas I love medication. Not in an unhealthy way, but I absolutely was open to taking an antidepressant, or, you know, like, but that was a big no-no. That was a big no-no. So I wasn't allowed to seek medical, you know, like that type of care would have been a big no-no. So one thing that was recommended to me by my my midwife was that sometimes a subsequent pregnancy can sort of reset your body chemically. And fortunately it did. So then we had our second child, and it really just reset my body. It reset that postpartum depression clock. And I finally kind of felt like myself again. And you know, as much as you can feel like yourself when you have two children under the age of two and, you know, are drowning in an abusive marriage, but I no longer at least had sort of that physical, I was able to maintain my hypervigilance again. I think that's the best way to put it. I was able to get back to that go, 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 to keep facing that reality at bay. I had developed obviously a lot of avoidance tendencies from my childhood. And so as long as you can just keep moving, keep going, keep doing, then you never have to actually face your problems. But that's not true. So then that was kind of the status quo for the early, you know, the young parenthood phase of our relationship. So then we get to the beginning of the end. And that actually began with the birth of our third child. So we had waited a little bit longer, like a more reasonable amount of time to have our third. And I really wanted a baby girl, and, you know, there was all the things like I wanted a third, and but I was nervous that I would have postpartum depression again. But to me, it was worth the risk. Like I wanted another child. And, so I was pregnant and, ended up developing, HELLP syndrome, which, they don't really know the cause of. It's your liver eventually just starts to consume the placenta. So it's essentially advanced preeclampsia, which in, you know, preeclampsia is what women die of in childbirth in modern days. So I was dying, and I was only 27 weeks pregnant at the time, which is the average pregnancy is 40 weeks. So I was not even into my third trimester yet. And so we had to deliver my baby girl at 27 weeks into the pregnancy just to save my life. And so obviously that is like an extremely traumatic birth and an extremely traumatic situation. And as I knew from the past, when there were sort of outside stressors and I could no longer maintain this hypervigilance, maintain this normalcy for him, right, that the abuse was going to pick up. And so I remember I was sitting in the emergency room. I had gone in and, you know, the doctor came in. She was like, you have HELLP syndrome. You might die. Baby might die, you know, but we'll try to make that not happen. But you're not leaving until you deliver this baby. And I remember my mind, the very first thing that my mind went to was, oh my God, he is going to be so mad. I do not have meals planned for the next few days. Like, what am I going to do? And like that was one of the biggest light bulb moments for me, was someone had come in and told me that I was dying and that my baby was dying. And all I could think of was, like, my mind immediately jumped to caretaking him. It immediately jumped to, you know, making sure that he was taken care of, right? I think that was just a major a major eye-opener for me. So then 5 days postpartum, so she was born, she lived through it, and just kind of barely at times there, but we were 5 days postpartum, and I had had a C-section, and so, and it's very challenging to just sit up from lying down once you've had a C-section. And so I was laying in bed waiting for him to help me up, like just to help me sit up so I could get out of bed and go to the NICU to be with my daughter. And he just went off on me about how selfish I was about, because I just go off to the NICU and I just sit there all day with the baby and leave him there, and he has to figure out meals and he has to watch the boys, and you know, and like, and I, but I knew it was coming, right? Like that moment I had in the emergency room, I knew it was coming. I knew, and that was, again, just these light bulbs of light. I had been through enough hard times with him to know that these patterns manifested a lot more during stressful times. And so all that to say, you know, the NICU experience was extremely draining on me, not only from, you know, just managing my daughter's care and being there every single day, to managing also having to deal with him, his abuse and all the things from, because he was then having to actually do some things around the house, right? Like he then actually had to take care of the kids a little bit, and he actually had to make meals, and he actually had to, you know, like, which if you've been with a narcissist, you know that they do not like that. So it was like that. My friends that stepped up to offer to help, everyone would be like, how can you help? How can you help? And I would be like, can you help him? Because he needs a, you know, like, can you make meals, but meals for him? So I was asking people to make these specialty weird diet meals, right? Like, no this, no that, yes to this, not that, you know, and just to bring to the house for him. So the care that was offered to me, I even just passed on and extended to him, because I needed that as like a buffer. I needed people to just take care of him so that I could just independently deal with A, my own trauma from this experience, and just care for my daughter who was, you know, essentially on life support. So obviously that was like a major stressor, and I began, that was really when my physical health from all of this abuse really started to manifest. To this day, I am so grateful that my daughter was born when she was. That's so terrible. And not for her sake, but the part that I'm grateful for is what, how that helped me escape my marriage. And I, without that major stressor, without that moment, you know, like without all of that trauma, I probably would have just kept going and maintaining this hypervigilant status quo for years and years and years. So I started having panic attacks, and like extreme panic attacks. I like would like hyperventilate and would pass out, and, you know, all the things. And so finally, for the first time in my marriage, and I think there was also this public eye that was on us because of our situation with my daughter. Like family and friends were sort of finally watching us, right? He could no longer do some of the like really restrictive abusive things. Like I wasn't allowed to go to therapy on my own. I wasn't allowed to pursue a higher degree like he was. I wanted to go to law school, but that was a big no-no. but we put him through his master's program. And I think everyone sort of seeing me really crumble. Everyone, you know, it was sort of this, I'm going to therapy. And he couldn't really say anything else about it because he would have to deal with everyone else saying something at that point, right? So I go to therapy, and that's really where this journey, like where the end came about. I fortunately found a therapist who was specialized in EMDR therapy, which is just a type of therapy that is found to be extremely effective for survivors of narcissistic abuse. We began the EMDR therapy for obviously the trauma from the birth. But as we were going, we obviously were uncovering all the rest of this, right? The abuse within my marriage, the abuse in my childhood. It was a long and hard year of EMDR. EMDR is extremely physical. You know, you leave a session and I struggle to move. I get really sore, you know, like it feels like I just got beat up. Cause you carry it all in your body, and EMDR helps you to sort of access that. And it,
so I have a question. What was the first, I guess, memory that popped up that you, that you like kind of bumped into that got you down that road?
That's great. So we started initially with the NICU. So like with the birth, right? So we started with like, let's picture, you know, you're laying in bed about to go in for your C-section and you don't know if you're going to live or if she's going to live. Let's start there. So, you know, and you hold these probes in your hand, and it's this bilateral stimulation, and it, it just helps ground you in the present while accessing traumatic experiences. Because with trauma, it's like PTSD and then CPTSD, which I also have, you know, the trauma becomes displaced in your timeline in your life. So you are you essentially relive these experiences at the wrong time. So, you know, it can be months later and you have these, you know, the panic attacks. That's what was happening. I was experiencing this traumatic birth in that moment, even though that had already passed. So part of EMDR is to sort of ground you in that and to like place these events in the timeline in your life. We started with the birth trauma. We actually then jumped straight back to childhood. And the marriage stuff, we didn't touch until several months later. There was still so much denial, and I was so used to protecting him. That was huge. Because he, as a covert narcissist, he was so good at controlling how other people saw him. Everyone loved him. Everyone. My racist grandmother, God rest her soul, loved him, and he is not the same race as me. And so, like, it was all a part of the gaslighting, all a part of the manipulation. No one was going to believe me about any of this, right? Because he is the golden child. He's the golden child in his family, the golden child in my family. Like he is worshipped everywhere we go. All our friends love him. You know, like it was just this perfect storm. And so we didn't get to unpacking the marriage stuff until about 6 months into that intense trauma therapy, when all of a sudden I was like, oh, we just started pulling at those similar threads. And it was like,
So is that how your therapist got you to at least go back into childhood, because you were trying to take a similar thread of what was happening in the postpartum stuff? And you're like, let's see what happens in childhood. Maybe there's a connection here somehow.
So you
went backwards to figure out a connection. And then in the process, you started going forward and things started getting uncovered. And then your therapist was like, we're going further. I'm not giving you a choice. We're just doing it.
Yep. Okay. Absolutely. So at that same time too, I had a close friend who was going through something similar. Her husband was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, which is similar in a lot of ways, you know, a cluster B personality disorder, but manifests quite differently. But either way, you know, she was sort of unpacking this hidden abuse within her relationship as well. And so we would go and, you know, we'd go on runs together, and she would, she recommended this book for me because she was sort of saying these things. And I was like, that's normal. That happens in every relationship, you know, like which of course you put someone who's married to someone with borderline with someone who's married to someone with NPD together. And they'll be like, no, that's totally normal. Right. Like that's just, you're fine. That's a good marriage. Just, you know, the toilet bowl, isn't that what they call it? It's like where you're both just sort of spinning in the toilet bowl and you're like, this is great. This is toilet bowl advice.
I have no idea. I've never heard that term before in my life.
Okay. Well, Google that.
I thought you were about to say water cooler talk, but no, it had nothing to do with that.
No, where you're both actually in the same toilet, like you're both spinning down to your doom, but you're like, no, this is fine. This is normal. Anyways, so.
You were circling the drain together.
We were both circling the drain at that point. So she had recommended some books that she had just sort of been, you know, getting into, again, with a similar, she had a very similar story. Like, they had children, and it was always there, but then it got worse, and things, you know, then couples therapy and blah, blah, blah. Same story, different day. And so I read The Emotionally Destructive Marriage by Leslie Vernick, and I found it really helpful because with covert narcissists, when I started my research journey on narcissism, which wasn't until after this book, but when I started my journey, some of it doesn't fit with covert. Some of it doesn't work because that grandiosity, it absolutely exists, but in a very different way. So that grandiosity isn't this like showboaty, oh, look at me. I drive this awesome car and I do all that. Like, their grandiosity lies in sometimes, for me at least, it was those expectations. His grandiosity was what he expected of me. He expected a perfect body. He expected me to cook meals. He expected me to, you know, not have wants or needs. He expected me to be capable. Like, there was all these expectations around what I needed to be. And that was his grandiosity. No one is capable of maintaining what I was maintaining, you know, which obviously crumbled over time. So I read the book, and the book gives you this really good sort of template to walk through with them. And you share, you know, you ask them a few, it's like a compliment sandwich. You ask them a few questions, you know, how do you feel about our relationship and all these things, and here's some things I love about our relationship. Here's some things I don't. And here's some things that, again, that I appreciate. So, I share this with him and, you know, initially the question was, you know, how do you feel about our relationship? And he shared, you know, he feels great. Everything's good. Then I shared my compliment sandwich and, he sort of retreated into his office for several hours and emerged with a 3-page typed out document of pretty much how I have ruined his life. And he didn't want to move anywhere that we moved. He didn't want to have children. He didn't want anything, and that I always get what I want. And I'm too demanding of him, and, you know, all the things, and which the book I had read said, if you're sort of met with this, you might want to go down these avenues. And it discusses the cluster B personality disorders. So that was kind of my first, the really big, like, you should probably look into narcissism. So then I really dove into the research with narcissism and like narcissistic abuse, and which is actually an avoidance technique. So instead of feeling the deep feelings of how awful it is to be treated this way in your marriage and, you know, the pain that comes with it, and just I found comfort in just reading and reading and reading and continuing to just read more and more and more about narcissistic abuse.
But the reality is everyone goes through that process and does need to go through that process because they're just trying to understand, even though like they know how they're, you don't, you know, before you get to the feelings aspect, you know, most likely they're angry or sad. But, you know, before they even get there, they know that, you know, they're just trying to understand like what they're dealing with. And a lot of people who might think the show is ableist or something along those lines, we're not talking about, you know, really demonizing personality disorders. We're talking about the toxic versions of these people with these disorders, because not everyone is a toxic person. And understanding the ways they work or how they are behaving is crucial to kind of start unpacking or getting to the next stage. So for you though, you know, you felt like the reading of that book, it's kind of telling you that you're avoiding. So did you take that to heart?
Yes. So what that looked like was I was reading. I had figured out that he was a covert narcissist, and I knew everything there was to know about narcissism, and yet he was still around, right? Like what was I then still doing? I didn't want to have to finally face him and leave. At that point, I didn't have a career, right? I was a stay-at-home mom. And I was extremely financially dependent on him. And I never went to law school or whatever, you know, like I never pursued my dreams. He had kept me in this tiny little box. And so I was so afraid with three small children to face this monster, to head down the monster of divorce, not the monster of narcissism.
And just to actually talk about this for 1 second, because, you know, you mentioned it twice already that he has stated that you get to do everything you want. And, yes. you know, and I guess there's a kernel of truth in there that makes you believe it, because, yeah, you did want to move. And there's all these little things that make you kind of believe these things that are being said. So early on in the podcast, you discussed financial abuse and other types of abuse. So with this instance where, you know, you have been out of the workforce for a very long time, you've been this stay-at-home mom, you know, when he's saying those things and saying that these are that, what, I guess, what are the examples that you kind of maybe throw back in his face, or you're thinking to yourself, you know, no, like I comply in this way, in this way, in this way, in this way, you know, and one of them possibly is that you are at home with your children. You aren't working, and, you know, how did the financial abuse, I guess, work over time in you, and for you to recognize that he's keeping you in this position so you don't leave?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, we were married so young, fresh out of college, you know, we had nothing, we owned nothing. You know, so we were starting at the very bottom, and, but so much of that was, part of the problem, right? Because we had nothing, we merged everything. So we shared all the everything. Every penny that came in was for both of us. And it wasn't, you know, it was, there were these expectations that, that I needed to make, you know, enough money and all the things. Whereas, you know, from my point of view with him, like, I always just wanted him to be happy, like, especially in his career. Like, I wanted him to just do what he wanted to do and to find his passion. And because I wasn't afraid to live poor, you know, like, I wasn't afraid of that. Like, I'm scrappy, right? So I was going to figure it out one way or another. So I think it was less of, like, the fear of, like, financial ruin for me, you know, and it was more just a really quick way for him to close doors on things. So I could never get individual therapy, right? Because we didn't have enough money for that. I couldn't go back to school because we didn't have enough money for that. I couldn't, you know, even get my own car because we didn't have enough money for that. So it's like we've really just, which the reality of that was actually true for a long period in our marriage. Just with his career and, you know, just the struggles and everything that we went through financially, but, you know, like student loans and things like that. So then I did what I always did, right? I turned to my own resourcefulness. And so I started my own business, which was extremely successful. And, the next obvious step, because I was working, you know, way too many hours from sunrise to sunset every single day of the week, I wanted to purchase property for this business and to hire people to help me because I was operating as a sole proprietorship. And so, but absolutely, that was a big no-no. If we were going to spend money on property, it was going to be for a house for us and not for my business. And then, so I stopped that and I really sort of, took a step back with my career at that point. Because then it was, you know, time to have children. And so since things were sort of coming to a close with my business, it was just sort of the next natural step. And what's interesting is I was not the type of person, especially as a child, I wasn't like, oh, I'm going to be a mother someday, or I'm not the kind of girl who, like, you know, like, oh, your baby's so cute, can I hold your baby? I'm not, it's terrible. I'm not a baby person. I'm not like I never had that innate drive in me. And something did switch in me in my late 20s. I'm sure it was mostly biological, but, and I wanted children and I wanted each and every one of my babies. Absolutely. But that wasn't necessarily like my personality, if that makes sense. I always envisioned myself sort of climbing this corporate ladder or, being the CEO of something, you know, I'm an eight. Okay. Like I'm an Enneagram eight. I wanted to, you know, whatever that I wanted more, right? The lust for more, whatever. So, that was even really out of my character to be a stay-at-home mom, to just sort of stay within the confines of like raising my babies. And absolutely mad respect to every single stay-at-home mom on planet Earth. It is the hardest job I have ever done. I've had a lot of different jobs and this is by far the most challenging, and the most hours, to put in. Absolutely. but it, you know, it was sort of this subtle, slow, and as they devalue you, right, you start to believe less and less, like, you can do things, right? So I went into our marriage this, like, bright-eyed, you know, entrepreneur ready to take on the world. And, you know, eventually I'm shutting down my business and I'm not going to school and I'm staying home with my kids. And I'm, you know, like, because I'm believing these lies that he's feeding to me over time, which keeps me in that dependent state financially, which that is one of the biggest obstacles, absolutely, to leaving, is how will I survive? How will I feed my children? How does all of this work? Even the money to hire an attorney to leave is next to impossible to find. The financial abuse was very, very prominent in our marriage. Sometimes it was as subtle as, so a lot of it was he wouldn't buy me things ever. You know, like I would ask for things specifically for my birthday or anniversary, and he would not get those things. Part of that was also the devaluation rate. That was a great way for him to just say, like, I know exactly what you wanted and I didn't get it for you. And, you know, it got to the point where I became very clear about what I wanted. You know, there was less of the like, oh, I hope he surprises me with, you know, X, Y, and Z. It was like, I want this thing, please. And that's it. Like, it's $40 and that's it. Like, can we, you know, and, but then, you know, birthdays and anniversaries and things would come and go and, those things would never show up. And so, and even the subtleties within that, but gifts is one of my big love languages, and how he would, the devaluation there. He would say that, you know, like only spoiled people have gifts as their love language, or that's not a real love language. That's like one of the fake ones. And, you know, like, and all these things where it's legitimately a real, like that is a real thing. It's okay to want gifts and to give gifts. And I think that was the bigger thing, was once he stopped buying me things and doing things for me, I then started to do those things for myself, which that was a lot easier for him to manipulate, right? For him to shame me on, like, you need to stop spending money. You need to stop doing this. You need to do that. And, So it was this gradual shift, right? From the love bomb early on and him buying me things and all these nice things, and then to him not buying me things, so I bought them for myself, and then to me doing none of that and to being fully financially dependent and knowing that if I spent money, I was going to have to face him, right? I was going to have to hear it when I got home. And honestly, even just the transactional relationship that he would use with sex, like it became, you know, this, that's fine as long as, you know, then, you know, insert whatever sexual favor here. And how that was one of the bigger pieces for me to undo in my journey out of this, was how much sexual abuse was present within my marriage. Because I think so many people just don't, you know, like once you're married, especially the Christian narrative, I should say, is like, you know, you go from this purity culture mindset of like, don't do anything and don't, you know, like, absolutely not, save it for your wedding day. And then it's your wedding day. And then it's like, okay, now everything's fair play, have fun. But then in that process, you never build these normal, the normal social parameters around sex, right? It becomes this, you're taught as a Christian woman that, you know, that's something your husband needs. And so you should just, you know, give it to him, because even if you don't really want it, that's okay. He wants it, and that's what's important. So there's, again, these subtleties of religion sort of playing this role in gaslighting, in having taught me my value and taught me my worth as sort of less than, and not to listen to myself, but to listen to other people, that his needs were more important than mine, instead of it being a mutual thing. And it, and marital coercion is rape. It's not, you can't package it any fancier or nicer than that. It's not okay. And that was huge in our relationship, was I just had, if I wanted to avoid the cycle of abuse, the stonewalling, the devaluation, all I had to do was put out. That was it. And, it was, that was really hard to unpack in therapy, was how much sexual abuse there was even within our marriage.
So, I guess, where were we when I asked that question?
Discovering narcissism and deciding to leave. Yeah. Okay, so after having read a lot of those books and finally understanding what I was dealing with and understanding narcissism and narcissistic abuse and everything just fitting so perfectly, it took me a while. It took me several weeks, but eventually I asked him to move out, and through this process, he was constantly pushing my boundaries, right? Boundaries are a big no-no for narcissists. And so me actually finally having boundaries was, as you could imagine, causing a lot of issues. So towards the end, there was a lot of fighting, a lot of just problems and tension, because suddenly I had a voice. Suddenly I had wants and needs. Suddenly I wasn't just rolling over, right? And I was doing this very differently than in the past. I wasn't angry and yelling. I wasn't, you know, like I wasn't I wasn't going into that trauma response. I was calm and cool and just suddenly was learning my own value and suddenly learning what I deserved. So with that friend who was, taking her journey through her toxic marriage, we signed up for it was a group therapy class on domestic abuse. And it was obviously, again, the money stuff being huge there. So it was a class I was taking that was kind of all I shared with him, that I was going to take this class. And the class advertised itself very carefully, like it was called a empowerment course or something like that. You know, like it wasn't, you had to call them to speak with them to know what it was actually about. Like it was sort of this word of mouth underground, you know, like, yes, we're here for domestic abuse. And that way it wasn't advertised as such, you know, like if your aggressive partner finds these things and knows where you're going, kind of a thing. So I sold some stuff on Marketplace to finance this class. And I went to this class for, it was a several week course. That was really the big turning point for me, was I was finally in a room with a group of women who had experienced very different but also extremely similar things, you know. And we, just hearing everyone's stories and sharing my story, and again back to that need to minimize that had been just ingrained in me as a child, sharing some of these stories and seeing people's faces, right? Like the shock value and like on their face, like that happened, you know, and where I had downplayed it so much. I had been like, yeah, but like that was a long time ago, or like, you know, like it's no big deal. Like it was so helpful to just validate me. I felt so validated for the first time in my life. So I asked him to move out. He did. He, at that time, my parents actually had, so my father has Parkinson's disease. And so when we were purchasing this home, they wanted sort of in on the space, like make sort of a space for them to kind of live out their golden years and just sort of always have a permanent address. That way they could travel the world and, retire, but not have a house somewhere to maintain, if that makes sense. So the basement here at my house was, for them, it's like a little 2-bedroom apartment down there. So, at the time that was actually a major protection in this journey out, because he wasn't going to stay here with my parents. So him leaving actually made sense, right? Like he needed to move out and go stay with his mom because my parents were here. At which, again, just that added layer of protection. It was like, no, like you wouldn't want to stay here with my parents, so why don't you leave? And I'm so grateful for that. And so then he moves out, and eventually he's pushing and pushing and pushing to go to couples counseling. He just wants to go to couples because, again, then he can hide behind me, right? The problems can become about our relationship and not about him, and he can't hide behind his mask. And I told him, you know, abuse is not a couple's issue. It's an individual issue. And I don't need to go to, there's no communication technique that is going to work our way out of this. Like you need to, I'm still continuing to go to therapy. Absolutely. I have so much I need to work on in myself, but you also do too. And there may come a time for couples therapy eventually, but probably not. Because it was already really dissolving at that point. So then he, again, kept pushing and pushing for couples counseling. And I finally agreed, but I only agreed to go to the one session to tell him that I wanted a divorce. You know, he always liked to set it up. He always found the therapist, right? He found, because it needed to be his thing to control. I had to just sort of show up to these people. And I asked for her contact information for the therapist that we were going to be seeing. And she said that, he told me that, you know, like, oh, no, we're just, here's the location of it. We'll just meet there. You know, like, again, beating around the bush, he wouldn't give it to me. So I ended up tracking her down online. And I sent her an email. I wanted her to know what I was going to do. I wanted her to know that this wasn't going to be some normal beginning of a couple sessions, that he's a covert narcissist and that there's been extreme abuse and it's time for me to leave. And I need to tell him about the divorce, but I want to do it with someone else present, just for fear of my own safety. And she was great. She was like, absolutely. I'll see you on Friday. Like, okay, great. So, you know, in that session, he was doing all the same things that he always did, which honestly, I was so grateful for. There was so much of me that was just blinded for so long that I couldn't see it. I couldn't see the abuse that was right in front of me. I was so tricked. I was so used to the gaslighting that it was so hard to undo in my mind. And it gets to the point where you gaslight yourself. You start to you don't trust your own reality beyond, because they teach you to doubt yourself. Like it's a real mind game. So fortunately he was doing all the things that at that point I was more empowered with all this knowledge, right? So I knew what he was doing. He was blame shifting. He was, it was all just manipulation and the, future faking and the, you know, I've changed and it'll be different and all the things. So I listened to his side of the story and then I shared, my piece, which I would love to share now.
Sure.
With you. all right. So this is what I told him. 13 years of abuse. If I died today, I will never have had the privilege of experiencing love. I deserve to live a life where I can be loved for simply just being me. This cannot happen with you. Your inability to empathize means not only is every word I'm sharing now falling on deaf ears, but also means that you're incapable of love in the way that I am. I have spent years empathizing with you, knowing how horrible your family treated you. And in that process, I became a codependent enabler, allowing you to abuse me. I'm sorry for the role I played. I thought I could help you, and that wasn't fair to either of us. I'm not going to walk you through a list of ways you were abusive. You already know all the ways. It's just how you're wired to control and manipulate everyone in your life. Instead, I will share with you a list of basic human rights, all of which are impossible while in a marriage with you. I have the right to say no. I have the right not to be abused. I have the right to express anger. I have the right to change my life. I have the right to freedom from fear of abuse. I have the right to want a better role model for my children. I have the right to raise my children in safety. I have the right to be treated like an adult and with respect. I have the right to leave the abusive environment. I have the right to be safe. I have the right to privacy. I have the right to develop my individual talents and abilities. I have the right to earn and control my own finances. I have the right to make my own decisions about my own life. I have the right to change my mind. I have the right to be believed and valued. I have the right to make mistakes. I have the right not to be perfect. I have the right to love and be loved in return. I have the right to put myself first. I have the right to be me. In order to provide myself with these basic human rights, I'm walking away from our marriage and filing for divorce. You often like to share with me that you did not feel loved by me, I acknowledge that I likely never did and never would fulfill your grandiose expectations. But know that I did nothing but love you, and love you well. Now knowing what I know, I am extremely empathetic and capable of some of the deepest forms of unconditional love, not cold and heartless as you had me believe. It is time to extend my love and empathy to myself and save myself from this abuse. When the denial and blame that I know are coming arrive, or even the more sinister, manipulative apology, know that you have the power to prove me wrong. Prove me wrong and let me go. Prove me wrong and don't engage in legal abuse, dragging out the divorce. Prove me wrong and co-parent well. Prove me wrong and actually respect my boundaries. Prove me wrong and continue your journey in therapy for our kids' sake. I am not leaving because of a lack of effort or growth from you now. I am leaving because of the 13 years of abuse. So I shared that, and then, you know, it's been a wild ride since then. We have very limited communication because that's what all the books say to do. So I Grey Rock method with him, and it, you know, all the things were there, right? The legal abuse, the financial abuse, the, you know, it's even the co-parenting things. It's already there. And it's been a journey, but at the same time, it's been so great to be free from that. On the drive to that appointment, I had been having for several years, like severe pain in my kidney, one of my kidneys. And I had even done like ultrasound, lab work and all this stuff, and nothing's wrong with it. No one can find anything wrong with it. But it's just part of how and where my body carries the pain, like the abuse. Like it's just a physical manifestation of all of this. And I was, you know, trying really hard not to vomit. It got to the point at the end of our marriage when he was still here that I was vomiting every day. Just him being near me was, I was really deteriorating physically, at the end. And so on the drive there, I was a mess. I was in so much physical pain and so ill. And I walked out of there after having shared that. And I was just, I felt a foot taller. I felt lighter. I felt incredible. Like my body physically felt like this, the freedom, like it felt the weight being lifted, from that.
And, you know, in the process of all of this, and after you get divorced, you have, I guess, the self-discovery that you are gay. And,
yes.
You know, once that happens, and that's its own journey, is that used against you in the aftermath of everything and whatever contact you have? And how does, I guess, in the aftermath, that play into how you feel about everything? Because I'm sure there might be people out there saying, well, if you were gay the whole time and in the marriage, how could you love him? So how do you go about the process of unpacking kind of all of that and then not re-traumatizing yourself or re-triggering yourself with everything that happened?
Absolutely. So part of my journey in therapy, even before he left, was me, you know, beginning to accept my sexuality. And I had always considered myself, you know, just bisexual, but that I chose men because that was easier, right? Because of trumpet or whatever, you know, and that would be more accepted by my family. So, you know, but it was, I've always known this about me, right? This wasn't, I've been out to myself for a long time. And, but now with my marriage ending, it actually just sort of finally became an option again. You know, if I never, like, I'm just not I'm an extremely monogamous person, and no offense to anybody who's polyamorous or whatever, like, that's great, fantastic, but that just doesn't fit me. And so I knowingly and willingly chose a man to marry, and sexuality is so fluid. It's hard to, you can't say that I never enjoyed, you know, sexual interactions with men. Like but that doesn't necessarily change what my preference is also. Like it's so hard to unpack because I was sort of assuming that I needed to just consider myself bisexual because I had been with men and because I had enjoyed being with men. But either way, with my marriage now ending, I knew that I was no longer going to date men or be with men. Like that from there on out, I was only going to be with women. Call it again. And then there's the whole debate of labels and call it whatever you want to call it. But, after he had moved out, after I had filed for divorce and all the things, it was finally time for me to come out to my parents, because they lived with me. And so this was obviously not just something that they could, you know, not notice, like if and when it became time for me to start dating again. Either way, it was just something that I was proud of and wanting to accept and finally, you know, share with the world. And so in order for me to come out publicly, even on social media or in any other aspect, I needed to, you know, come out to them. And so I shared with them, you know, the whole kind of big picture and how that, you know, what my dad said early on was like a very big moment of how he shared, you know, I'm always here for you. Just don't be a lesbian, essentially. And how formative that was. And, but that a big piece of my journey out of this and what kept me in the abuse was that I was so deeply embedded in people pleasing, in the caretaking, the enabling, I was so worried what everyone else thought instead of just being true to myself and listening to me and what I wanted. And so if I'm unraveling that, if I already am pulling that thread, right, and I'm already getting a divorce, which is already a big no-no, right, then to me it was sort of like, well, I'm not going to pull all the thread and leave this here. So it was sort of rip the Band-Aid off, I guess, so to speak. My dad was very accepting and, apologized for what he had said in the past. And that I think he said, I don't care if you're green or gay, I'll love you no matter what, my mom was just, you know, she started diving into what the Bible says about marriage and how God designed marriage and just like how deeply she's so embedded in purity culture even. It wasn't a coincidence that they moved out a week later. We'll just say that. So with my family, though, like part of that toxic structure is we just don't talk about things, right? So it wasn't, we're moving out because you're gay. That is why they moved out. But we would never admit that. We would never talk about that. It would never be this. If ever there was a time when I needed my parents' support, it was in leaving my abusive marriage and trying to raise three children on my own and trying to financially support myself, and my children for the first time. And, you know, there's so much that they could have sort of offered, and could have been there to help with. But, I knew that's how and why you stay in the closet for 30 something years, right? Is, you know, that their response isn't going to be what you want. And so I knew what I was risking in coming out to them. And so to say that our relationship is strained would be an understatement. But it's been, I'm also really grateful for that piece of it, because it's helped me come to those bigger realizations too about just the level of toxicity in my upbringing. And even the amount of narcissistic abuse in my childhood, and why I was so primed for it, and why it felt so normal to me for so long in my marriage. And I read the book, Will I Ever Be Good Enough? It's fantastic. It's about maternal narcissism and how different it manifests, which that's wildly interesting to me, and how different it looks, but at the same time, the aftermath, the way I feel, the way my body responds is exactly the same. And it's been a long journey. So, but coming up for them at this, while it was, you know, a very life-altering moment in just even my immediate day-to-day, right? I suddenly was alone and raising my kids on my own and, you know, doing all of that. It was still just so freeing and so amazing to just be finally able to accept, fully accept myself. And in that process of, you know, publicly telling people about the divorce and then publicly coming out, yes, there was a lot of kickback of like, oh, well, the abuse probably didn't happen, right? Like, I made all that up, and it's just because I was gay that all of this existed. Or, you know, like, it added this extra layer of gaslighting to my leaving process of, instead of, you know, everyone really seeing the picture of how it's all so closely tied together, right? Like, I had been gaslighting myself my whole life because of my sexuality. And so I stayed in the closet, right? And that I am capable of loving, you know, a man, and that, like, that I chose that marriage, and I openly chose that. And I would have stayed, you know, just a closeted bisexual for the rest of my life if our marriage had been different. And, but what I think the biggest realization is that, yes, I left because of the abuse, but I actually should have left because of my sexuality. Like, I actually, that was enough reason right there to love myself well and to actually listen to what I wanted and needed. And, yeah, it's been a year. It's been a wild ride, so to say. But it's self-discovery is probably an understatement there. But it's been, part of it is so good, right? That journey out of narcissistic abuse, part of it is like, oh my gosh, I'm free of this. And then part of it is realizing how permanently ingrained a lot of it is. And how, especially with CPTSD, you know, like realizing that the majority of my personality is essentially a trauma response, like my extreme independence and my sense of humor and my, you know, there's a million things about me that are literally just in response to the trauma that I've endured in my life, and that I will always be facing and battling this, you know, this inner war. But now knowing that I have the help that I need, and that I'm, you know, seeing professionals, and I'm, you know, on medication, and I'm I'm able to just journey through that in a much more supportive way, if that makes any sense.
So if you have words of wisdom or words of advice for people going through the same thing, what would you tell them?
I would say that the places where I have found community among other survivors have been extremely healing and helpful for me. I mentioned the group therapy class that I took, finding that camaraderie there. And then I share a lot of my story now, now that we're divorced and all the things, and I'm finally just sort of processing a lot of that and sharing it on TikTok. And there's an extremely large community on TikTok of, they call it Narc Talk, and it's narcissistic abuse survivors. And I am so grateful to have found that community, those friendships, because so much of the abuse is that mind game, right? The gaslighting, the getting you to just not believe yourself. You'll have these moments of like, is this even real? Did this even happen? Like, is this? And to be able to share some of those stories or some of my experiences and then have, hundreds, thousands of people, agreeing and just saying that they experienced something similar and that they understand it. It's extremely validating. And again, in sharing my story, it's been not only healing, for other people to connect with. People are reaching out to me a lot on TikTok saying, like, your story sounds so familiar. It's so similar to mine, and then, we're able to just connect in that way. But then it's also really healing for me to just share my story. And not everyone, should share publicly. Not everyone needs to process their trauma publicly on social media. But I have found that what narcissistic abuse did for me was kept me small, and it took my voice away. And it has been so nice to reclaim my voice and to tap into that healthier side of my Enneagram 8, right? To be that protector, that voice for the voiceless, and to, just be able to share what I experienced and hope that somewhere that my story can just help someone through that time. Because getting out of a relationship with a narcissist is the hardest thing I have ever done, ever. But it's possible, and it's so much better on the other side.
Well, thank you, Aurora, for being on here and sharing your story and, letting it all hang out for everyone to see. I know you are, a big advocate for everyone in the community, and doing the show is part of that. And I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for being here and sharing today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You are welcome. And for everyone else, I hope you, for everyone who is listening, I hope you have a good night.